Alors écoutez, merci d'être ici ce matin, lundi, c'est courageux. Je voulais vous souhaiter la bienvenue à ce nouveau cycle de conférences organisé par le regroupement Droit et Changement et initié par le CRDP, les matinées constitutionnelles. Bienvenue et merci à nos deux invités, Maître Scheidman et Professeur Schneiderman. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. Sur les matinées constitutionnelles, un petit mot très bref avant de céder la parole à André Lajoie. La formule est très simple, elle se veut simple et sans chichi, si je puis dire. Un, deux ou trois invités, comme vous le voyez ce matin, vont s'entretenir d'un thème et on souhaite que les discussions à la fois ont pu suivre sans formalisme particulier. Des échanges qu'on voudrait donc plus proches du séminaire que d'un colloque ou de la conférence. Et dans le cadre de ces matinées, on a l'intention, avec le comité scientifique, d'aborder des thèmes assez novateurs qui touchent le constitutionnalisme, bien entendu, mais qui empruntent aussi à plusieurs secteurs, si l'on se fie au découpage universitaire, le droit constitutionnel bien sûr, mais aussi le droit international, la théorie du droit, le droit du commerce international, l'histoire du droit, voire même la sociologie du droit. Bref, on aspire à sortir un peu des barrières du découpage de la discipline juridique pour essayer d'embrasser le plus largement possible des thèmes qui s'intègrent difficilement de prime abord dans un secteur particulier. Et donc des thèmes aussi, comme peut-être celui d'aujourd'hui, qui démontre peut-être le caractère daté des fois de nos divisions universitaires, mais ça c'est un autre thème. Alors ce cycle de conférences, je vous disais, s'inscrit dans les activités du regroupement droit et société, qui réunit outre le CRDP de l'Université de Montréal, évidemment l'Université McGill, et aussi l'Université Laval. Alors la première matinée se tient ici, mais la prochaine va se tenir de l'autre côté de la montagne à McGill, et la suivante à Québec, à l'Université Laval. Et je tiens aussi, en terminant, à remercier les collègues qui ont bien voulu généreusement et aimablement accepter de participer au comité scientifique des matinées. André Lajoie, je remercie. Louis Bernard, qui s'excuse de ne pas être avec nous. Ghislain Otis, Fabien Gélina, Jean-François Gaudreau-Desbiens et Jean Leclerc. Merci beaucoup à vous tous. Alors, maintenant que la formule est esquissée, je cède la parole à notre présidente de séance.
Alors, bonjour, bienvenue. Merci d'être là, comme on vous a dit, un lundi matin, là, aux aurores. Et nous allons aborder aujourd'hui un thème qui s'intitule « Le nouveau constitutionnalisme ». Je ne sais pas si vous êtes comme moi, je me suis sentie tout à coup très dépassée en me disant « qu'est-ce que ce nouveau constitutionnalisme ?» jusqu'à ce que je me rende compte que c'est quelque chose que l'on pratique, comme M. Jourdain faisait de la prose sans l'avoir nommé. Mais pour vous dire vraiment de quoi il s'agit, avant de vous présenter les conférenciers, eh bien, je vais demander à Karim, qui écrit un papier là-dessus de ce temps-là, de nous dire de quoi il retourne.
Voilà, merci. Alors, très rapidement, parce que la conférence va se dire en anglais, je vais faire un petit exposé d'une dizaine de minutes sur ces questions. Alors, tout d'abord, évidemment, on note, vous notez tous avec moi, une crise du constitutionnalisme qui se fait jour en raison très souvent de l'impuissance du droit constitutionnel à limiter d'autres pouvoirs que celui de l'État. Alors qu'émergent, on le voit de plus en plus, de nouvelles formes d'exercice et d'organisation du pouvoir, mais notamment de la restructuration de l'espace public, en particulier dans le contexte de la mondialisation. Alors le droit constitutionnel libéral semble donc incapable de trouver des solutions pour répondre à ces défis posés par ces nouvelles formes de pouvoir diffus, hein, parler comme Foucault. Alors deux obstacles semblent se faire jour pour une sorte d'actualisation du constitutionnalisme. Tout d'abord, cette philosophie libérale qui sous-tend le constitutionnalisme selon laquelle il faut arrêter le pouvoir de l'État, pour ménager aux individus, évidemment, vous le savez, une sphère privée de liberté et d'autonomie, et permettre au marché d'exercer son entreprise. Et d'autre part, un autre obstacle, c'est la nature jusqu'ici très marquée par la dogmatique nationale du constitutionnalisme, qui en fait toujours une chose très locale, très nationale, qui peut peut-être constituer un obstacle. Alors, se dessine, avant d'en arriver au nouveau constitutionnalisme, qu'on pourrait appeler un autre constitutionnalisme, à défaut d'expression. Un autre constitutionnalisme qu'on connaît, qui semble se profiler, qui a pour objectif à ce moment-là d'étendre le champ d'action du texte constitutionnel afin de répondre justement à la montée en puissance du marché et de la globalisation des échanges. Ça, c'est un second dans cette catégorie haute, si je puis dire, constitutionnalisme, là j'espère que je ne suis pas trop obscur, socialisme que je qualifie de global, qui se dessine également, et dont la finalité, serait de doter la sphère internationale d'une constitution susceptible, entre autres, de faciliter la coopération des États, mais surtout peut-être celle des acteurs transnationaux qui deviennent de plus en plus importants. Ce second socialisme, en quelque sorte, alors que le premier, qui tente d'étendre l'action du champ constitutionnel, porte son attention sur la chose nationale, tout en tenant compte des phénomènes de mondialisation, pour vouloir éventuellement inclure les entreprises là-dedans, ou le marché. Le second socialisme concentre sa réflexion sur les sphères internationales et transnationales. Alors là, on est en présence évidemment d'un intérieur et d'un extérieur, un in et un out, si on peut dire. Et cependant, tout cela porte en germe la possibilité théorique de s'abstraire de la dogmatique nationale et finalement de se fondre. Mais il y a aussi le nouveau constitutionnalisme, si je puis dire. Et ça, on peut se saisir de cette question par un autre bout de la lorgnette. Alors, une certaine doctrine note, ça c'est une vision un peu pessimiste, mais c'est assez convaincant, que les réformes des 30 dernières années, la privatisation, la libre circulation du capital, la dérégulation des marchés, diminution du rôle de l'État, libre-échange, etc., que ces réformes ont en quelque sorte constitutionnalisé le programme néolibéral par l'adoption d'instruments internationaux qui contraignent, on le sait, la capacité du souverain de dire le droit, puisque l'ALENA, tous ces textes, s'imposent au gouvernement. Et aussi, deuxième élément, la formidable diffusion, dont cette doctrine note aussi, de l'idéal constitutionnaliste libéral à travers l'adoption de maints textes constitutionnels dans le monde depuis les années 80. Alors à ce moment-là, selon cette doctrine, il faut appréhender la mondialisation économique en des termes constitutionnels. Pour deux raisons. D'abord, il y a une équivalence fonctionnelle entre les règles internationales, transnationales et les règles constitutionnelles, puisque dans les deux cas, elles contraignent des générations futures. On doit faire comme. Et aussi parce que ces règles internationales et transnationales globales imposent leur teneur normative aux règles législatives, même aux règles constitutionnelles, et qui requièrent de ces dernières une réformation. Alors, le choix du terme nouveau constitutionnalisme pour désigner finalement ce qui est la constitutionnalisation et la protection des intérêts corporatifs me semble un peu malheureuse. Je préférerais l'expression constitutionnalisme à rebours, qui plutôt que de protéger les droits des plus vulnérables, se trouve à garantir en fait ceux des plus forts. Mais cette thèse n'est pas isolée, je laisserai le soin à David Schneiderman d'exposer la sienne et également à Maître Schreiman de le faire. On note simplement un formidable exercice de constitutionnalisation que le monde a connu dans les 15 dernières années, des pays de l'Est, en Afrique du Sud, en Nouvelle-Zélande, en passant par l'Amérique latine, effervescence constitutionnelle. Et est-ce que cette effervescence constitutionnelle est liée à des grands motifs humanistes? Alors selon Rand Hirschel de l'Université de Toronto, qui aussi est un tenant de ce nouveau constitutionnalisme, pas du tout. Cette tendance vers une constitutionnalisation n'a rien à voir avec un élargissement du pouvoir judiciaire ou une vision humaniste des choses. Sa thèse est plus audacieuse. Très rapidement, il dit que le processus de constitutionnalisation auquel nous assistons peut s'expliquer comme le produit d'un jeu stratégique entre trois groupes sociaux prééminents. L'élite politique qui cherche à préserver sa domination en soustrayant certains processus politiques des vicissitudes du débat démocratique. Je donne des exemples assez convaincants à cet égard en Israël et en Afrique du Sud. L'élite économique qui apprécie la constitutionnalisation de certaines libertés de nature économique, droit de propriété, droit de mobilité, qui contribue à promouvoir des valeurs néolibérales et qui surtout sanctuarise ces valeurs, peut plus les contester ensuite. Et l'élite judiciaire qui évidemment est très contente de tout ça parce qu'elle accroît ce faisant son influence politique et son prestige international. Donc finalement, ce constitutionnalisme viserait à préserver et à isoler de l'arène démocratique, et donc de la majorité, des intérêts politiques et économiques afin de garantir la prééminence de leur titulaire. Hirschel note aussi que ce transfert ne s'effectue pas seulement vers le champ constitutionnel, mais aussi vers des bureaucraties internationales comme l'OMC, les banques centrales, les tribunaux supranationaux. Et ce transfert, évidemment, de certaines prérogatives étatiques entraîne un anonymisement de la souveraineté. Et il fait des entreprises transnationales, dont on parlait il y a quelques minutes, des acteurs politiques importants du monde global. Leurs intérêts sont préservés, souvent mis hors d'atteinte, par cet exercice de constitutionnalisation. Alors, cette vision est tout à fait soutenable, elle est peut-être un peu pessimiste, mais elle est là. Et on peut se demander, au-delà de celle-ci, si l'affaissement de ce paradigme statocentrique, celui de l'État, ne permettrait pas peut-être justement un nouveau souffle constitutionnaliste, qui permettrait peut-être de discipliner, de soumettre les entreprises transnationales. Je pense d'abord à un constitutionnalisme interne, national, qui étendrait sa portée, n'est-ce pas, en faisant en sorte notamment peut-être d'obliger l'État, on a toute cette théorie allemande là, un devoir positif de l'État, celui-ci serait sommé d'agir et non pas simplement de s'abstenir pour défendre les libertés, et peut-être un constitutionnalisme global, rêvons un peu, qui nous permettrait de sortir des limites de l'État-nation et d'englober des acteurs, non étatiques, dont l'importance est aujourd'hui considérable. Mais évidemment, tout ça, c'est des projets, c'est des idées, c'est un riche débat, et je vais, sans plus tarder, céder la parole à nos deux invités. Thank you very much.
Alors, je vais avoir le plaisir de vous présenter nos deux invités qui vont débattre de la question, après quoi le débat sera ouvert à la salle. Je vous signale que si vous voulez, nos invités vont parler en anglais, mais si vous voulez présenter des questions en français, vous pouvez le faire. Je ferai mon possible pour bien les traduire en anglais pour que nos collègues puissent répondre. Alors, nous commençons avec David Schneiderman. Avec Steve Strydon, qui est avocat à Ottawa chez Sack Goldblatt Mitchell. Il œuvre dans le domaine du commerce international et des questions d'intérêt public comme l'environnement, la santé, sur laquelle il travaille très fort en ce moment pour nous éviter la privatisation, le droit du travail, les droits de l'homme, les ressources naturelles, la propriété intellectuelle. Il a œuvré avec des ONG pour la promotion de la diversité culturelle. Il a même contesté, plus proche de nos préoccupations d'aujourd'hui, il a même contesté la validité de l'appartenance du Canada à l'ALENA, rien de moins, et réclamé l'accès de l'eau comme droit de l'homme. Il a publié surtout sur le droit du commerce international. Alors,
merci.
Well, good morning, everybody. And let me begin by apologizing for the fact that I'm maybe speaking in English and that I lost my notes. So I'm very grateful that you're not at court. I had to proceed without them. Unfortunately, I found them. I'm going to, I think, set the stage for And let me also say just how pleased I am to be here. I've had an opportunity to address the Faculty of Law once before with respect to these questions of constitutionalism and the radical development of international law that's occurred over the last 15 or 20 years, but that was only once. It was the University of Saskatchewan. I think it was in 1998. And notwithstanding the import of these international legal developments, they've gone virtually unnoticed. David certainly is an exception, but not just in academia, but in the legal community writ large. These developments have virtually gone unnoticed, and there's very little commentary on what they mean for constitutional orders and democratic society, and that's unfortunate. And so I'm very happy to be here this morning, and I'm pleased that you've taken an interest in these issues. I think thanks probably in large measure to André Lajoie, who's been of great assistance to us in formulating our case, which is now pending before the Court of Appeal in Ontario, and I'll tell you more about that in a moment. But I want to begin by describing the mechanism itself of investor state litigation as that is written into the rules of the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. And those rules are set out in Chapter 11 of the treaty. And I'll just give you an overview of that chapter and of the dispute resolution mechanism itself. So Chapter 11 is divided essentially into two sections. The first that says the substantive rights that foreign investors enjoy in Canada, and that element of the investment rules. The substantive rules themselves were actually features of the Free Trade Agreement with Canada and the United States that was implemented in January 1st, 1989. The second part of Chapter 11, Part B, is the dispute resolution mechanism. And that was new with NAFTA. That had never, ever been a feature of an international trade agreement before that, and largely still isn't, although it is incorporated into a very large and ever-expanding number of bilateral investment treaties. This mechanism is not a feature of the WTO, and there is no multilateral agreement that engenders this dispute resolution mechanism or sets it out. So let me begin with the substantive rules of Chapter 11, just so you have a sense of what these disputes are about and how they're formulated. And there are, I don't know whether there are 17 or 18 substantive rules, but I'm going to describe the three most important. The first is national treatment, which entitles foreign investors to as favorable treatment as a government accords a domestic investor. And that's defined both with respect to the provincial sphere of constitutional competence and in terms of the federal government's role as well. So at a provincial level, if the province of Quebec accords a particular preferential rate to a manufacturing company with respect to hydroelectricity, that sets a standard which it then must meet with respect to all other, not with respect to all other investors, with respect to all foreign investors. So it entitles foreign investors in a particular jurisdiction to the very best treatment that that jurisdiction accords to domestic investors. That's national treatment. Let me just give you a sense of how that plays out. There was a case brought against Canada. It's the S.D. Myers case. S.D. Myers is a company based in the United States. It treats PCB wastes. At a certain point, Canada closed the border to PCB exports from Canada. It didn't just close the border to U.S. companies that wanted to export PCBs from Canada. It closed the border to all exports of PCB waste from Canada. It did that because of various developments that had happened in the United States and because it's obliged under the Basel Convention effectively to constrain the exports of hazardous waste and provide for domestic treatment. But in any event, Canada closed the border. It was challenged by S.P. Myers, and the tribunal came to the conclusion that even though the measure, the ban on exports of PCB waste, was non-discriminatory, that in effect it had more of an impact on a company operating in the United States than a company operating in Canada. And because of Canada's national treatment obligations, it wasn't acceptable and ordered damages against Canada for having imposed the ban. So this notion of national treatment as interpreted by these tribunals becomes a very large, expansive, and as I'll come to in a moment, somewhat ill-defined concept. The principle of national treatment has also been invoked by UPS. It has brought a challenge against Canada. Its basic challenge is that it shouldn't really have to compete with Canada Post in areas in which Canada Post doesn't have an exclusive monopoly, which is in the areas delivering courier products and packages. It has a monopoly with respect to letters of a certain size, but not in these other areas. And UPS argues that by allowing Canada Post to integrate package and courier and mail delivery, the government of Canada has effectively treated UPS in a discriminatory manner because it doesn't allow UPS access to the mailboxes on the street for people to drop off their products. It has different rules for UPS packages arriving in Canada compared with packages arriving that are sent through the U.S. and Canadian mail system. I don't have enough time to describe the cases in any detail, but I want to give you a sense of the breadth of that notion of national treatment and the way it can be deployed by ingenious lawyers who see an opportunity to make an argument. In the case of UPS, basically to diminish a sphere of public sector service delivery, because inherently it diminishes the market for the private sector. And you can imagine precisely the same arguments being made in the context of healthcare, particularly as this province is on the verge of opening the door to more private investment in the healthcare sector. Why do public hospitals have certain rights under Bill 33, which I'm dimly kind of familiar with, and private hospitals not, if they're allowed to establish in this province and foreign investment is allowed to enter into this? You can imagine precisely the same arguments that UBS has formulated being deployed in this context as well. That's national treatment. Another rule of Chapter 11, which has been important in the cases, is 1105. It's this notion of the state owing the obligation to accord fair and equitable treatment to foreign investors. Again, a very broad concept, a very ill-defined concept under international law, but as interpreted by the tribunals, it's been used to impugn the allocation of softwood lumber quotas under the export quotas under the softwood lumber agreement with the U.S. It's been invoked to challenge the decisions of domestic courts. That hasn't happened in Canada, but it's happened twice in the United States, and I'll come back to that. But these cases involve foreign investors invoking the jurisdiction of arbitral tribunal to sit in review of decisions of U.S. or Canadian. There have been no Canadian examples, but the same rules would apply, of course, in Canada, to review the decisions of domestic courts, including courts at the highest level. And what is being argued in those cases is that the way in which the courts have conducted the adjudicative process or interpreted statutory and common law has failed to meet the standard of fair and equitable treatment, which the parties are obliged to provide foreign investors under the treaty. I often hesitate to describe this mechanism to people because it seems so implausible in some ways that a country might agree to a mechanism that had that breadth of scope and, or that empowered private tribunals to sit in review of the decisions of the Supreme Court of Canada, for example. It seems implausible, but nevertheless, that is the way the regime is constructed and how it's actually been deployed and used. The third is this whole concept of governments not expropriating private investment or implementing measures that are tantamount to expropriation. That, if you think of expropriation in a conventional sense of actually taking real property, you miss kind of the point that this rule has been invoked to allow corporations to challenge the environmental regulation of a non-discriminatory application in a famous case involving a small Mexican rural community brought by the U.S. hazardous waste company Metalclad to challenge land use planning measures and public health protection measures and water, groundwater protection measures. It's just interpreted very broadly and successfully in some cases. So that just gives you a sense of the flavor. There have been, I haven't gone in to do a tally recently, there have been 30 or 40 of these cases. They've challenged everything from procurement to public services. I mentioned in the UPS case, the common target is environmental law and regulation, land use planning controls, judicial decisions. I hope David will comment on this, but one of the disturbing developments that has occurred in this context is that there has been no decision made against the U.S., even though I think an objective assessment of the cases would indicate that they have been as strong or stronger than some of the cases that have prevailed against Canada and Mexico. I think that's a consequence of the character of the adjudicative process, where you basically have a private adjudicative regime where the adjudicators are not independent, that are dependent upon the parties to be reappointed. The per diems are attractive. It's in U.S. funds. I think it's understood that were a case to be decided against the United States, that the goose that's laying the golden eggs might be slaughtered by Congress. I think Congress would put up with an international, a private international tribunal sitting behind closed doors deciding that U.S. law and regulation or the decisions of U.S. courts are not acceptable under this trade regime. And I mean, that's something that's very difficult to establish, but there's this disturbing kind of pattern of cases, including some very far-fetched cases succeeding against Canada and the U.S. and some very meritorious, against Canada and Mexico, and some very more meritorious cases failing against Canada. So briefly, the mechanism. If you have a complaint that Canada or Mexico or the United States has done something that doesn't comply with these obligations and others, which I haven't had a chance to describe, you have the right, the unqualified right, to file a complaint and to and in consequence of, there is one qualification on your right. You actually have to waive. You have to consent to arbitration, and you have to waive your right to pursue a similar complaint for domestic courts. Not a complaint involving judicial review of the measure involved, but a complaint for damages, because that is the remedy that these tribunals can provide. But once you've done that, you have the right to take your complaint to arbitration, because the consent of the parties to NAFTA is actually hardwired into the text. It's unilateral, it's given in advance, there is no privy of contract between the investor and the state that's required. As long as the investor qualifies as a foreign investor, and that's a very low threshold, and as long as these two conditions are met, the filing of a complaint which represents consent and a waiver of domestic remedies, they're entitled to proceed. A panel is impaneled. It really follows the norm of arbitration under a collective agreement. Each of the parties appoints a nominee. They choose a third. The procedures are ad hoc. They may proceed either under the additional facility rules of something called the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, ICSID, which is a construct of the World Bank, are under the UNCITRAL arbitration rules. The UNCITRAL arbitration rules are the construct of the United Nations. And the shape of that adjudicative process really is determined by the parties, as would be true in an arbitral dispute where typically, the dispute is one that is essentially private in character, so why would you notify third parties or contemplate that they might want to appear and participate in the dispute resolution process? What they've simply done is taken a construct which has evolved under international law, really dating from the 50s, which was established to resolve disputes arising under contract, essentially of a private character, and providing for their international adjudication, and imported it into a trade agreement that now allows countless foreign investors to invoke this regime in order to challenge domestic measures that aren't private, aren't contractual, but are issues like environmental law and the delivery of public services that engage public policy and law in the broadest possible context, and yet the mechanism itself has all of the features of an adjudicative mechanism that doesn't involve any broader interest than the interests of the parties to the particular dispute. The tribunals have the right to accord damages. There's no doctrine of stare decisis that applies, so each tribunal in succession is entitled to interpret the rules as it chooses. And the cases themselves have been very inconsistent in terms of their reading of the formal text and what those disciplines imply. Unlike the WTO, there's no appellate body, so there's no institution that's incapable of imparting any discipline or order or predictability to the ad hoc views of these tribunals. There is an opportunity for judicial review. I'll come to that in a moment. Judicial review is available in the place of arbitration. The place of arbitration is chosen by the parties, if they can't agree, by the tribunal itself. It's only in that jurisdiction that a court has any authority to review the decision of the tribunal with respect to jurisdiction. In the case of UTS, place of arbitration is in the United States. So if Canada is unhappy with the decision of the tribunal, the only court with authority to actually set aside the award will be a U.S. court. It might have been a court in any other country that's a party to something called the New York Convention. And I'll return to that in terms of its constitutional implications in a moment, but just so you understand the landscape. Let me describe our case. I represent the Canadian Union of Postal Workers and the Council of Canadians, both of which were, engaged in the counter-revolutionary offensive against globalization as it's been codified in international trade and investment treaties. But they took a particular interest and very concerned about the development of these privately enforceable international investment rules and very engaged in the campaign to defeat something called the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, which was an effort to take the NAFTA disciplines and write them into a multilateral agreement because efforts to have incorporated them into the WTO had failed, and the MAI initiative failed as well. But there, we're particularly interested in the UPS case. The postal workers, you can imagine why they were interested. But they were particularly interested because not only was UPS putting at issue the right and capacity of Canada Post and the federal government to formulate public policy and law as it relates to delivery of postal and related services, but UPS even complained about pension benefits that postal workers enjoyed as being accorded preferential treatment. They had been civil servants, and there was a migration of their pension plan from any event. There was a complaint about that. There was complaint about the collective bargaining rights of rural mail carriers. What else did they do? But issues that clearly engage the interests of a trade union and Canada Post employees. Council of Canadians brought concern about globalization, about the erosion of sovereignty that arrives in consequence of all of that. Also had someone on the board who represents Rural Dignity Canada, and one of the issues around postal service, of course, is that there's a universal service obligation that Canada Post has to provide service, whether it's economically efficient to do that or not. Of course, the private sector doesn't have that obligation, so there was a concern about the erosion of the capacity of Canada Post to do its job and to serve all Canadians, regardless of their circumstances or ability to pay or whether it made economic sense to service them or not, particularly if they lived in rural areas. So they retained us, and we brought an application to participate in the case. We argued we should be given party standing. The tribunals basically put us off, though reserved on the question of whether or not we might be entitled to have an amicus brief considered by the tribunal. They received, the way it works is that they don't tell you whether you have standing. They say, well, give us your brief, and we'll tell you when we render a decision whether or not it was of any help. So, and make sure that it's not more than 20 pages. And by the way, you can't see the evidence. And so we spent our 20 pages condemning the process, and the tribunal has that, and the case was argued in last December. I think it's taken about 5 years to get that far, and we're waiting for a decision with broad implications if the tribunal finds in favor of UPS. We also, at the same time, brought an application before the Superior Court in Ontario to challenge the mechanism itself as unconstitutional, and we made several arguments. The first, and we think the most substantial, is that this effectively delegates improperly the authority of superior courts to resolve disputes between private interests and the state concerning issues of public policy and law. The other, another is that it offends more broadly the notion of the rule of law and constitutionalism to establish tribunals which are appointed by the executive in collaboration with private investors to sit in judgment of every conceivable feature of domestic policy and law, even the decisions of appellate courts. We also make a charter argument, not that these tribunals have given rise to decisions that offend charter rights, but rather that creating tribunals that are incompetent to consider the charter and nevertheless empowered to determine issues that clearly have broad implications, that act is unconstitutional and offends the basic structure and architecture of the Canadian Constitution. We argued the case before Madam Justice Pepl. I can't remember how long ago that was. I think June of 2005, I believe. And she didn't agree with us. And we argue that what she did was all flowed from two basic misconceptions about the nature of the argument and the challenges engaged by this mechanism. The first misconception we argue that the judge fell victim to was the notion somehow that this was a distinct sphere of international law that never alighted on the landscape of Canadian constitutional law to an extent that would attract the principles of judicial independence that are engendered by Section 96. This was international law. Section 96 in the Constitution is here, and the two are entirely distinct spheres, and you can't use one to assail the other. That was the first misconception we argued that she labors under or labored under. The other is that really the investor state suit mechanism is indistinguishable from dispute mechanisms under other international treaties, and if she was to impugn this particular mechanism, that she would be throwing out the baby with the bathwater, the baby being Canada's capacity to negotiate international conventions of any character, environmental conventions or human rights conventions that would engender a dispute resolution mechanism. So let me talk about each of those, or the way in which we responded when we argued this case before the Court of Appeal to those basic questions, because I think they're fundamental to the case. So I won't take you through the case law or the methodological analysis that follows from the residential tenancies case and McMillan-Blodell. I've got to deal with this in kind of a larger conceptual construct, if I can, because I think those are really the challenges that are engendered by the case. To begin with, in terms of this notion that this is a distinct sphere of international law that doesn't have any resonance and doesn't attract the disciplines of the Canadian Constitution, we said, well, that's wrong, both as de jure and de facto. De jure, we argued that the mechanism is actually incorporated and depends upon domestic law, including Canadian law. You can look to the NAFTA Implementation Act, which in subsection 4 of section 5 actually acknowledges that this dispute resolution mechanism exists. But you can also find it in consequential amendments to the Commercial Arbitrations Act, which specifically acknowledged that decisions rendered by these tribunals would be enforceable as decisions rendered by any other international tribunal, the Commercial Arbitral Tribunal. So we said you can find that relationship there as well in terms of the incorporation to Canadian law of this international dispute resolution mechanism. But it's also dependent upon domestic law in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, the regime depends upon domestic courts to perform a certain judicial review function. And so it isn't isolated from domestic law or domestic judicial processes in that regard either, because they're, you know, in the absence of any appellate body or any institution that could impose any discipline on this private adjudicative regime, there is an opportunity to bring an application for judicial review. It's very narrowly defined before a court in the place of arbitration. And finally, the decisions of the tribunals are enforceable as decisions of domestic courts. That's what's accomplished by the amendments to the Commercial Arbitrations Act. So the notion, you know, that as a matter of law, this is a distinct sphere of law really doesn't hold up. It isn't certainly a feature of domestic law, but probably most accurately is it's a hybrid. It has international legal features and domestic legal features, and the two are integrated, and the construct can't stand without that integration. And without its incorporation to Canadian law and its reliance upon domestic courts for judicial review functions and for the enforcement of arbitration awards, it wouldn't mean anything. So the notion that as a matter of law it's a distinct entity that has no domestic resonance is simply wrong. Now David will, I think, describe how in fact the mechanism is pervasive in terms of its influence over domestic law and exerting a really substantial constraint on the formulation of policy and law, because now the policymakers and the lawmakers have to look over their shoulder. You know, a whole army of foreign investors who may be able to use these ill-defined disciplines in a very creative way to assail domestic measures. If there's any argument that they're discriminatory or they're expropriative, as the report for the Romano Commission indicated, an attempt to expand the sphere of public health care that might infringe on the terrain of private insurance companies or home care providers or long-term care providers, all of that suddenly engages this threat of foreign investor claims. I actually spent a couple of years in cabinet office in Ontario in 91 to 93, this is before NAFTA. I never attended an interministerial meeting about an environmental initiative, which is basically why I was there, where the threat of an international trade complaint wasn't raised, usually by an economic ministry that wasn't supportive of the environmental initiative proceeding, often by someone who didn't understand the trade agreements very well, but could invoke this in a room of bureaucrats who knew them less and use it to chill enthusiasm for policy and regulatory reform. So at a practical level, it's pervasive, it's pernicious, it existed before NAFTA, and it's only become more extreme in a country like Canada. I don't think this is true in the United States necessarily, or nearly to the same degree. So that's the question of independence in law, very briefly, in fact. Let me deal with this other notion that the judge seemed to be so concerned about, which is that she would impugn Canada's ability to negotiate international treaties with enforcement mechanisms, just simply to say that our response to that is that this is very much unlike any enforcement mechanism that now exists under international law. And here are the points of departure. And the WTO is probably a good point of reference because it's an international trade agreement. Under the WTO, the only parties to disputes are states. And they have reciprocal obligations. One of the fundamental things about investor state, which is so different one, it's a dispute now between a corporation or individual, isn't a party to the treaty, has no obligations under the treaty. No reciprocal obligations at all. Any of the constraints that would typically apply to state-to-state dispute resolution, which are diplomatic, they're tactical, they're legal, there are lots of reasons why states may be sanguine about invoking rules that they have to comply with as well in order to assail the public policy and law of another nation. Doesn't exist under this particular instrument. Foreign investors have no reason to assert anything other than the most broad and expansive interpretation of these disciplines, because there's no reciprocity and no downside. The state actually exercises no gatekeeper role. It isn't as if you have to go to a nation state before you get to invoke this mechanism. The consent of the state is given unilaterally and in advance. So any foreign investor can invoke. There's only one area of dispute which is actually reserved from NAFTA, and that's certain measures under the Foreign Investment, the Canada Investment Act. Only those measures are reserved from investor state litigation. So even in areas where there's some reservations under Chapter 11 for healthcare, they're very limited, we argue, in their scope. But even the character and extent of the reservation can be litigated. So there's only one small category of public policy and law that's reserved from investor state litigation, and the state has no gatekeeper role. It can't prevent its own investors from engaging this process and bringing a dispute. That's very different than any dispute resolution mechanism. There are a couple of exceptions, and perhaps you'll ask questions about them, but certainly the dispute resolution mechanisms of the WTO. The enforcement of the award is only between, is not between the state, but between the private investor and the state. That's another distinguishing feature. The fact that awards are enforceable through domestic legal processes is also utterly unlike certainly any enforcement mechanism in any international treaty, including human rights conventions to which Canada is a party. You know, if there's a dispute under the WTO and it's unsuccessfully resolved to the satisfaction of the disputing parties or the claimant, the remedy is a retaliatory trade sanction. It's a domestic measure which the other country can put into place. It can't take a damage award and take it to the country in a dispute between Canada and Europe over beef hormone bans. And Europe can't take a judgment to the European court and enforce it as against the European community. That's not permitted. And indeed, in the character of the tribunals, these aren't really known rules. There's no discipline. There's no appellate body. You're not choosing people from a roster of adjudicators, which would be true under the WTO. All of the process is ad hoc. I've run out of time to cover the whole question of judicial independence. But in some ways, we thought this might, though my colleagues disagree with me, at the firm. I thought this was the most offensive feature that might engage or provoke the interest of a judge, that their own judgments could be reviewed by these ad hoc tribunals where the executive is actually appointing the adjudicators, where there are no known rules, where not only matters of procedure, but matters of substantive legal interpretation could be reviewed in a very probing way. And, the judge just dismissed this with very casually saying, well, they don't exercise a formal appellate power, these tribunals. And that's true. There's nothing these tribunals can do. They don't have the authority to actually set aside the offending measure. They just have the authority to award a disputing investor tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. UPS is claiming claim started at $250 million. I'm not sure what it thinks it's entitled to, but if you don't imagine that that's a formidable constraint on a nation kind of maintaining an offending measure, then this total disconnect between the form and the consequence of the substance of the consequences of these adjudicative regimes. This mechanism has been invoked to challenge the most fundamental features of democratic process. In the Ethyl case, Ethyl manufactures a fuel additive. Ethyl was the company that brought you lead in gasoline, or brought all of us lead in gasoline for so many years. And when that was finally banned, they had a new idea, which is something called MMT. It's banned in most OECD countries. Canada decided it would go the same way Chapter 11 was invoked. Canada backed off. Wrote the company a check for its legal cost of $19 million, sent them an apology saying, we don't know what we were thinking of when we banned the substance, and we'll never do it again, and we got rid of the regulations. But in the process of bringing its claim, one of the things that Ethyl impugned was the fact that its reputation was harmed by the debate in Parliament about the need for the regulatory mechanism. And I find that quite astonishing, but the one I thought would get the judges most was that in the UPS dispute, there was a fight between UPS and Canada about where the place of arbitration would be, because ultimately that would be the court, the only court in the world that could set aside the judgment. And UPS said, well, we don't think it should be in Canada because we don't think Canada's attitude about this mechanism is very exemplary. And what it presented the tribunal with were the pleadings of the Attorney General of Canada in a case that proceeded before the BC Supreme Court. That case was brought by Mexico. The challenge, an award made against it in the Metalcod case, which remember I mentioned very briefly earlier. The place of arbitration in that case, and don't forget this is the case between a U.S. investor, the government of Mexico, it was actually heard in Washington, D.C. But they chose as the nominal place of arbitration British Columbia. So when Mexico had a complaint about what this tribunal had done, the only place it could take the complaint was to a B.C. Supreme Court. I find that astonishing just in and of itself. But nevertheless, Canada showed up and said, well, you know, you've got a Commercial Arbitration Act, and we agree that it applies to these international investor disputes, but we don't think that the deference that courts have typically shown to such awards should apply in this case, because the deference, and it was well established as a feature of Canadian law, that is shown to a dispute that's essentially private in character, and which is justified if you want arbitration to be a viable mechanism for resolving commercial disputes, doesn't have the same place when dispute involves domestic policy and law, a broad public interest, and the consequences of which affect a great many people beyond the parties to the dispute. So we think the court should accord less deference to an award arising under NAFTA than it would an award arising under a typical commercial arbitral agreement. And the tribunal looked at this and it said, this is disturbing. We're worried that Canada would have taken this view. This is the view expressed by the Attorney General of Canada. I'm sorry, I'm harping on this, and of course all of you understand this better than I do. In submissions to the BC Supreme Court about the interpretation which the court should accord a BC statute. But this tribunal had the temerity to comment on it and explicitly take it into account in deciding that in the UPS case, the place of arbitration would be the United States. Now that kind of censure of that function by a state, the right of the Attorney General of Canada to take a view on Canadian law, I think is really truly astonishing and very offensive. We'll see. We don't think we got a very sympathetic hearing from the Court of Appeal, so we'll see. But it's been many months now, so we'll see what they have to say. Let me just conclude by saying that, I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I have a very eclectic practice, and I suppose I do a fair bit of litigation, but I don't think of myself as a traditional lawyer in any sense. But I do think of these developments as really quite profound. I mean, there's been a radical transformation of the framework of international law that has dramatically expanded its scope. If you look at the WTO and these other agreements, they're not about trade of goods across borders. They're about services and investment, which is effectively every feature of domestic policy and law. You can't identify one, including the land use planning zoning bylaw next door, whether your community decides to ban pesticides. Even at the most local level, those measures are now engaged by these international disciplines, even the more so in a globalized economy in which we're all integrated into a global economic and industrial construct. And what's so different about these regimes, in addition to the fact that they encompass everything now, is that they're truly binding and enforceable. That wasn't true of the GATT. It wasn't true prior to the advent of the WTO. You weren't at risk. I mean, GATT may rule against you, but ultimately, if you didn't agree as the offending country to the sanctions, they weren't implemented. It was a consensual regime. That's not true under the WTO. And what you've done with these investment treaties is to put it on steroids. Because now it's just not countries that can invoke these disciplines one against the other. It's any investor. I think the investment community, the number of cases is exploding. I think David will explain this. I think they've been slow to realize just how powerful this mechanism is or even that it exists. My friends in the private bar tell me they have a hard time getting the attention of their corporate clients, and they're dubious when they hear about this. It seems so implausible. But nevertheless, I think they're getting over their skepticism, and they're beginning to invoke it. And one of the most remarkable features about these developments is they've gone, as I began my talk today by noting, almost unnoticed. This is the second time I'm hardly the scholar on this subject, but there was really all, other than David, an awful lot of people that could describe it and tell you about it, and it's just, ignored. It's rewritten the constitutional landscape in the most profound way you can imagine, in terms of division of powers, in terms of the role of parties, the fundamental constraint fettering of constitution. You have to be living in la-la land to imagine it doesn't fetter, you know, the authority of future government. And of course, the whole question of judicial independence, which resides at the heart of the Section 96 argument. So we thought we might, you know, provoke the courts into taking an interest in the fact that their work has been contracted out under this regime. And we'll see how far we get. But thank you very much for being here.
Thank
you very much for this panorama of the invasion of the droit constitutionnel by the privatization of the international droit. Nous allons maintenant passer à David Schneiderman, qui a fait ses études à McGill, j'ignorais, et à Queens, qui est maintenant professeur à Toronto, comme chacun sait, et qui a pratiqué le droit aussi, lui, en Colombie-Britannique. Il a été directeur de recherche au Canadian Civil Liberties Association pendant 10 ans, et moi, je l'ai connu à l'époque comme directeur du de Constitutional Studies, un centre d'études sur les études constitutionnelles en Alberta. Il a publié sur le fédéralisme, sur la charte, sur l'histoire constitutionnelle, mais plus spécifiquement à propos de notre réunion d'aujourd'hui sur la constitutionnalisation et la globalisation, plus récemment. Il a édité plusieurs ouvrages collectifs, fondé la revue Forum constitutionnel quand il était au Centre d'études canadiennes constitutionnelles et également dirigé la Review of Constitutional Studies. Alors, David.
Merci Madame Lajoie, professeur Peignacliff. C'est un grand plaisir d'être avec vous aujourd'hui. C'est la première. Matin constitutionnel.
Oui.
Je regrette que mon présentation est préparée dans mon langue professionnelle, anglais, et pas en mon langue maternelle, yiddish. thanks so much for the invitation. It's a lovely opportunity to be here and to see some old friends. So, I've been asked to talk about my work in the new constitutionalism. I should begin by saying that Professor Benyacliff has basically described what I'm going to be doing for you, maybe in a little bit more detail. There are a few things I'm going to do. I hope it doesn't seem rambling. First, I want to situate the new constitutionalist scholarship in work on globalization more generally. So think about sort of some of the intellectual connections. Second, I'll speak to some of the rules Stephen already has mentioned to you, in particular the takings rule, the prohibition on expropriation or nationalization, or measures tantamount to expropriation and nationalization, which has been of particular interest to me. And lastly, in the third part of the paper, I'm going to draw on a new research project that's looking at mechanisms for rolling back this investment rules regime. I'm going to talk about, in particular, the Cochabamba water wars and a case that was pending before ICSID, the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes that Stephen has mentioned, that has been withdrawn. And so it's of interest that a large multinational corporation has withdrawn its claim for tens of millions of dollars of damages against Bolivia by reason of a coordinated transnational campaign of that includes local organizations, Bolivia, the Bolivian state, and also social movement actors in the United States, the Netherlands, Spain, and elsewhere. Okay, let me begin by talking about the new constitutionalism more generally. The new constitutionalism, of course, describes this new legal formation associated with economic globalization. New constitutionalism speaks to changes occurring both within and outside of states. So this, Professor Benyacliff mentioned this interesting inside-outside relationship. Legal changes are required both or expected from within, national legal orders, which is why Stephen could make the argument that NAFTA requires, in fact, legal changes and the absorption of these values into national legal orders, as well as the generation of a seemingly autonomous system of law that is constituted by, well, these investment decisions in particular that I want to talk about. States, of course, are expected first and foremost to receive in the performance of certain functions, particularly those associated with intervening in markets in order to redistribute wealth. States are expected to take measures that replicate mythical paths to development that were pursued by states in the North. And I emphasize mythical because usually the paths are not at all what states, particularly in the South, are expected to pursue. So constitutionally entrenched rights of private property together with institutions for judicial review are viewed as legal prerequisites to participate in the fruits of economic globalization, but these reforms at the local level are not sufficient. And so the new forms of legal regulation are proliferating in the realm of the transnational, and they, of course, implicate national legal orders, but are seemingly beyond their purview. And they represent binding legal constraints, as Stephen has described, on states that impede their ability to take action in relation to markets. And in an early 1995 essay, Stephen Gill, who teaches international political economy at York University, described at a very general and abstract level, under the influence of Gramsci and Foucault, the disciplines associated with the new constitutionalism. This is how he described it in 1995. These proposals emphasize market efficiency, discipline and confidence, economic policy and consistency, and limitation on democratic decision-making processes. The project, of course, is to make liberal democratic capitalism the sole model for future development by insulating, and these are his words, key aspects of the economy from the influence of politicians or the mass of citizens by imposing internally and externally binding constraints on the conduct of fiscal, monetary, and trade and investment policies. So the new constitutionalism refers to these binding constitution-like constraints intended to advance the neoliberal version of economic globalization. There are, of course, numerous examples of new constitutionalism at work, and Gill makes reference to the WTO. There are, of course, the regulatory capacity or disciplinary capacity of financial markets, regulatory agencies, and the thing that's been of interest to me, and also, of course, to Stephen, is what I call the investment rules regime, which includes not only NAFTA, but over 2,500 bilateral investment treaties, as well as numerous free trade and investment agreements. So work on the new constitutionalism really is a critique of new constitutionalism at work. And it's a subset of a larger body of work we might call critical globalization studies, which has five dominant features, and I think they reflect well the kind of work that some of us are doing in the field. And I'm drawing on a description of critical globalization studies by James Mittleman. Firstly, this work is reflexive. It's aware of the interests embedded in and served by the rules and institutions of globalization. It's historicist, so it's attentive to the historical dimension and resists descriptions of globalization as timeless, ahistorical, or denationalized. And this is often how the regime is described by, well, international lawyers, particularly the legal community involved in this regime. So the work is attentive to what Boaventura de Sousa Santos calls globalized localism, that is particular national legal rules going global. And in fact, one might understand globalization as a competition amongst differing national legal orders for hegemony in the transnational field. I think that's most exemplified by work by Desilets and Garth on international commercial arbitration. Thirdly, this work is decentering in that it seeks to decanter the dominant perspective of the global north and displace it with the perspective of the global south, or as is often used, the term, the subaltern. And so aims to sort of equalize conditions in which other people can participate in the rise of what we call the universal. So equalizing conditions to the universal is an idea I borrow from Bourdieu. It crosses over disciplines by necessity. This work has to be interdisciplinary. It's simply impossible to do otherwise. And so traditional disciplinary lines have to be abandoned in order to make sense of these contemporary phenomena. One needs history, one needs political economy, political theory, and law. And law has a particular contribution to make because lawyers can identify the instantiation of globalization through legal rules. And it's being done in various ways through legal rules. I think it's a particular contribution that the legal community can make to understanding the structuration of economic globalization. And lastly, it's counter-hegemonic in that it aims to displace the dominant ethos of markets, efficiency, and consumerism with those of democracy, experimentation, and accountability. So it seeks to expose paths toward hegemonic practice or counter-hegemonic practices, which is a subject I will take up in the last part of this presentation. And Professor Benyakuf is quite right that this kind of constitutionalism isn't entirely new. These ideas of limiting state capacity are traceable back to at least James Madison. The framers in 1787 were concerned about economic leveling and redistributing private wealth, and it's precisely what animates much of what goes on today. So in which case, back then as today, constitutional limits or constitution-like limits remain a useful tool with which to thwart legislative excesses. And so McGinnis and Movsesian, in a piece in the Harvard Law Review, describe the World Trade Organization in precisely these terms. They liken it to the institutionalization of Madisonian design of the U.S. Constitution at a global level, which is aimed at disciplining self-interested states, the creation of factions at the state level that undermine what they describe as global well-being. So in that way, of course, it's not an entirely new phenomenon. There are interesting new aspects to it, and one of them is the speed with which this new transnational regime has been created, essentially after the fall of the Berlin Wall at post-1989. Thousands of these treaties have been entered into. It's global breadth. It's not confined to a few colonies, but rather has spread literally into a worldwide web of constitution-like limitation. And of course, its pretensions to globality. It's for everyone, right, and for every state and every citizen. And in fact, it's best that citizens have similar rights to foreign investors, and then all would be well in the world. So, of course, the project is not just about, as I've mentioned, creating the transnational autonomous legal field, but to transform within national legal systems as well. So my own work on investment rules, I think, represents well this move towards limited government and deregulated markets. The investment rules regime is now, by the last count of the UN Commission on Trade and Development, over 2,500 investment treaties covering the globe, north to south, south to south, Cuba entering into treaties with other Latin American states. And they typically include particularly the three principal disciplines that Stephen has mentioned, national treatment, fair and equitable treatment, which I'll talk a bit more about, and also the prohibition on expropriation and nationalization, or measures tantamount to equivalent to expropriation and nationalization. It's this aspect of the regime that's been of particular interest to me because it looks so constitutional-like. It is a property right. It looks like it's drawn directly from national constitutional systems like the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment, prohibit takings of private property without just compensation. If the rule in the past at the international level has been concerned with outright takings of title by the state, Stephen is right. That's no longer really what it's about, although we should mention that Bolivia is purporting to take oil and gas and title in Bolivia. But these kinds of incidents are very rare. Rather, what the regime is concerned with are measures that simply are not normal, considered excessive, not normal by standards set by, well, the United States and countries of the OECD. These are regulatory changes that simply, quote, go too far, in the language of Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in an early takings case in the United States Supreme Court, a regulatory takings case. It's clear that the intention of the drafters of these agreements is to ensure that these regulatory measures that significantly diminish investment interests or legitimate investment-backed expectations are going to be caught by this rule. Okay. The whole object, of course, is not merely, I would maintain, to impose legal limits on state action, but actually to change the way in which citizens think about what states are capable of doing. There's a cultural aspect to this push towards new constitutionalism. It is about limiting the capacity of citizens to organize themselves and to imagine alternative paths to development, alternative futures. This is David Kennedy from his recent book, essentially making the same point about economic globalization more generally. The point is to limit the ideological range. Political choices fade from view, as do choices about among different economic ideas about how development happens or what it implies for social, political, and economic life. And there's probably, I think, no doubt that constitutional limits will shape, right, the way in which citizens and social movement actors will think about the capacity of the state to do certain work. There's a great study by William Forbath on entitled Law and the Shaping of the American Labor Movement, I think it's called. And he studies the way in which U.S. constitutional limitations shaped the way in which the U.S. labor movement imagined what states and the national government could do for the labor movement. And it's a very meticulous and well-done study about the way in which these values are internalized by the labor movement. And for me, this point precisely makes the point I want to make, which is that the idea here is to actually change and alter perceptions about what states are capable of doing. So it's not merely a legal project. It's a cultural one. And it's a cultural one that's derived from particular national legal systems. This is the idea of globalized localism. In a book-length treatment of this, it's due to come out sometime, I try and trace some of the 20th century origins of the Takings Rule. And it's largely an American and European project. But it has a particular affinity to the U.S. constitutional experience. It's clear, indeed, it's very, very clear that that's precisely what the Americans think the project is about. When George Bush sought trade promotion authority to enter into a series of free trade agreements with Central American states, Singapore, and some others, Congress debated the scope of these investment treaties and disciplines, and concluded that, in fact, their scope had to be limited somewhat because they went too far in the Congress's terms, giving investors greater rights than those available to citizens in the United States. What the object of the regime and the bilateral investment treaty program of the United States is about is to promote U.S. constitutional values and to entrench that model globally, in which case the model investment treaty in the United States was modified so that it would look even more like the U.S. Constitutional system And what the United States did was incorporate a series of factors that were developed by the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Penn Central that helped to identify what a regulatory taking is when a measure or regulatory measure simply goes too far. So those factors identified by the court are now expressly in new trade and investment treaties. And interestingly, Canada virtually adopted an identical new model treaty incorporating these very same factors developed by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so here you have the phenomenon directly of U.S., a particular version of constitutional limitation going global. Other states will, of course, be signing on to these treaties, and the United States has been very active post-Cancun after the failure of talks there. And Canada, of course, does this work for the United States by virtually replicating the same standard. Okay. That's my bit on the United States. It also might help to explain why tribunals haven't found yet against the United States. And one of the reasons is the perception that this merely replicates what's covered by the United States Constitution. That's simply not the case. Vicky Bean and Joel Bove have shown how much broader these investment disciplines are than the limitations in the U.S. Constitution. They cover many more interests, many more financial interests than does the U.S. Constitution. And so it might be yet that the United States will be bit in its behind by these rules. But the arbitrators will think that, and they're also reflexive, the arbitrators themselves. They're aware of these critiques. Some of them have mentioned them. And so they're careful. They're very careful about how far they'll go in fine making against the state. And what's happening, in fact, is the arbitrators are now paying greater attention to other standards, like fair and equitable treatment, and abandoning the takings of prohibition, which was one of the, I maintain, most constitution-like and most controversial of the limitations in investment treaties. Okay. The experience under NAFTA suggests that the investment rules regime has these constitution-like characteristics. The prohibition has been used by investors to threaten a variety of suits, a proposed public auto insurance plan in Ontario, but that was under the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, the cancellation of contracts to transfer public property at Pearson Airport into private hands. There's that threat. I've written about how major American tobacco companies threatened to challenge a Canadian ban or Canadian proposals mandating what's called plain packaging of cigarettes so that they have no trademark or trade dress on them, just plain brown paper wrapping, and the tobacco manufacturers threatened to sue for hundreds of millions of dollars for that. And more recently, it's likely that NAFTA's takings rule resulted in the government of New Brunswick rejecting a legislative committee proposal that recommended a public auto insurance scheme for the province. And actually, Stephen has written about this, really the best work on this. And exorbitant auto insurance rates were an election issue in New Brunswick, and Premier Lord struck a special committee to consider whether public auto insurance was the right thing for New Brunswick. There was lots of evidence before this committee, including that from the Insurance Bureau of Canada, who commissioned an opinion from McCarthy Tetro in Toronto, that U.S.-based private auto insurers could seek damages under NAFTA's Chapter 11 were New Brunswick to proceed to, nationalize the auto insurance scheme. The Premier rejected the committee's recommendations without any reference to NAFTA's chilling effects, although it's reasonably clear that it would have played a role, if not a dominant role, in the decision coming out of the Premier's office. Panel rulings have told us a few more things about NAFTA's takings rule. Virtually any interest will be covered by these investment treaties. Any economic interest will be covered by these investment treaties. The investment rules, the disciplines cover non-discriminatory regulations, and even measures falling within an exercise of a state's police powers jurisdiction. And the Polk and Talbot Tribunal, NAFTA Tribunal, said this. And police powers jurisdiction refers in the United States jurisprudence to measures that, by definition, are not takings and do not require the payment of just compensation. They are the categorical distinction between police powers jurisdiction and takings. And what the panel has said is that, well, actually, takings under NAFTA include police powers jurisdiction that swallows up the exception. And so what it suggests is a very, and Stephen's emphasizing it, the breadth of these disciplines on national legal capacity is extraordinary. However, the measures have to be substantial enough, right? They have to be excessive. They have to go too far. It can't just be a minor impairment of an investment interest. So incidental interferences are not covered. Rather, investment owners have to be deprived of a significant part of their investment or of the use or reasonably to be expected economic benefit of property. Deprivations, compensable deprivations under NAFTA may be required in even the case of a temporary or partial taking. Despite the breadth of this prohibition, there have been very few successful claims invoking the takings rule, and I think one of the reasons I've mentioned already, the tribunal members are reflexive. They're aware of the critique, and some have even mentioned just how far this kind of prohibition goes, and so are looking for other ways in which to well-discipline states that go too far in impairing investment interests. And what's really interesting is the recent rise of the fair and equitable treatment standard, which is considered part of the minimum content or standard of international law. And the fair and equitable treatment standard was an empty vessel early on in this in the development of the investment rules regime. It's being given content by tribunal members, scholars, lawyers who are appointed to sit as arbitrators. And what they've done is they've read into this fair and equitable treatment standard of protection a doctrine of substantive legitimate expectations. Substantive in the sense that states cannot deny or rebuke or refuse to recognize the legitimate expectations of investors. Legitimate expectations such as guaranteed rates of return. If an investor has been guaranteed a rate of return, that is a legitimate expectation the state simply cannot withdraw from substantively. It's interesting how the fair and equitable treatment standard is serving very similar functions as would the takings rule in the investment rules regime. In fact, the idea of legitimate expectations is precisely one of the factors that the U.S. Supreme Court has said you must take into account in determining when there's been a regulatory taking. And if there's been a denial of reasonable investment-backed expectations, then that is a signal that compensation should be provided to an investor. So the language, the idea, and theory behind legitimate expectations is also lies behind the takings rule. And so tribunal members have migrated these kinds of standards and protections to this other rather opaque and misty standard of fair and equitable treatment. And we're only just learning now about its potential scope. And arbitrators have been very active in creating this doctrine. And despite the fact that it's very ad hoc, it's not that these tribunals are not intended to create binding precedent one against the other, they're now often referring to each other. And so the community, really, of investment lawyers are generating this new doctrine that serves similar functions. And I think this is made most evident by a recent case, CMS versus Argentina. Let me just briefly talk about that case. This is one of, I think I said 47, some very high number of suits, suits pending against Argentina after its economic meltdown. And numerous transnational companies lost their investment, lost future profits as a result of the Argentinian meltdown. Michigan-based CMS participated in one of the waves of privatization of Argentinian public enterprises in 1995. They purchased almost 30% of a public company that transported gas across the country. So CMS bought into this company, PGN. And PGN secured a license with the government of Argentina that essentially provided certain guarantees. Tariffs that PGN collected were to be recouped in U.S. dollars, so everything was to be converted from the Argentinian peso to U.S. dollars, adjusted periodically to ensure that their rate of return was high enough. The meltdown of the Argentinian economy in 2000 required, of course, that the state abandon these kinds of commitments. They simply could not maintain them. In the case of natural gas, they temporarily suspended prices, freeze profits, and once they devalued the peso, which had been pegged to the U.S. dollar, payments to TGN would be made only in pesos and not converted into U.S. dollars. Everybody was hurting in Argentina, and foreign investors were expected to participate in the economic pain that was being felt. However, foreign investors, by reason of the investment treaty regime, are entitled to sue for their legitimate expectations under contract. So rather than participating in the pain, CMS filed a claim for damages using a United States-Argentina bilateral investment treaty. They argued that the essentially de-pacification of the contract amounted to the indirect expropriation of the company's assets, so a taking of their investment interest, and also a failure to comply with the standard of fair and equitable treatment, and claimed some $260 million U.S. Now, the government responded with a variety of arguments, and I can't review all of them here, but central to them is the idea that a government is entitled to change direction. Right? It should be free to change policies in order to take account of needs of social importance, as Argentina described them. No license or bilateral investment treaty could be read as freezing the regulatory environment. States should be entitled to, well, change their mind or react and adapt to economic necessity. The tribunal, of course, disagreed. And the structural tilt of the investment rules regime ensures that investors, in fact, will not only get their day in court, but will win the day. Now, again, interestingly, the tribunal did not find that CMS had a proper investment interest that gave rise to a taking, even though they likened their investment interest to a property right, virtually to a property right, but they did not find that there was a taking. Rather, they found that there was a denial of fair and equitable treatment. The company had invested in Argentina on the basis that the state would guarantee the stability of the investment interest. The state received tens of millions of dollars, right? So we've got its end of the bargain. CMS was entitled to its part of the bargain. In which case, the investment treaty would not allow Argentina to change its mind, reverse the commitment within only a few years. So the fair and equitable treatment standard was read as requiring a stable legal and business environment. That is an essential element of fair and equitable treatment, in which case the state was ordered to pay CMS $133.2 million. That's a lesser amount than CMS was claiming. The award is now pending before the World Bank, which has the capacity to annul or set aside these awards by ICSID tribunals. And the likelihood of that happening, I think, is very, very small. And the significance of this award, CMS, is that it's the first substantial award against Argentina in the wake of the economic meltdown, which will be of some importance to the 46 other pending cases before ICSID alone. Okay, I think I might have about 2 minutes left. Yeah, okay, good. So let me just talk about how this regime might be reformed or rolled back. And this is part of a sort of ongoing work that I'm doing. I think it's fair to say that the countries of the global north are unreliable partners in reforming or revising this new legal regime for reasons I've described already. The United States, for instance, when it sought to limit the scope of investment disciplines, did so in a way which would ensure that its legal system and its constitutional norms would be those that others would have to adhere to. And of course, there's a higher threshold, I think, of property rights protection in the United States than in most other constitutional systems. And Canada, of course, has been a willing accomplice every step of the way after NAFTA in imposing these kinds of disciplines on countries all over the world. Canada's program of foreign investor protection agreements lagged for a few years, but recently one was signed with Peru, and there are numerous others that impose these very high standards of review of a discipline on states. Europe also, I think, is unreliable. In which case, I think it's in places in the global south where we'll find some resistance. I have a paper dealing with South Africa, which was in negotiations with the United States for a new trade and investment agreement. And those talks ended without any agreement in place, in large part because South Africa was insisting that its program of black economic empowerment, which is controversial in South Africa and has numerous features to it, but is intended to essentially have black South Africans participate in economic development in the country and share in economic growth, was not acceptable to the United States. It was a deviation from its model investment treaty, and it wouldn't agree to play along with South Africa. South Africa naively thinking that the United States would in the interest of goodwill, would want to set aside its model treaty and help South Africa along. And there's always the threat of Zimbabwe lurking out in the background. So South Africa thought it could use this leverage against the United States, failed. Those negotiations are off track, no longer ongoing. And South Africa is promoting a different model of investment treaty as a result that's resisting somewhat the dominant hegemonic model. I want to talk about a case issuing out of Bolivia, and it's the case, the claim made by Aguas del Tunare. And it's a remarkable case because it's one where the claimant withdrew its claim after a successful interim award on jurisdiction, and the award on jurisdiction entitled the tribunal to proceed. It said it had jurisdiction to hear the case and then would proceed to the substantive merits of that case. And at that stage, the company withdrew. So it's an interesting case study, I think, of how to at least maybe put a halt to some aspects of the investment rules regime. So let me just briefly talk about the events that precipitated the claim, and many of you will be familiar with the water wars in Cochabamba, which has become a cause célèbre for the anti-globalization movement. So I'm sure many of you have heard of this or something about it. There's a good documentary on this. There's numerous articles in the press. But briefly, and so you've heard about this, if you've heard about this, I apologize. Briefly, the World Bank required that Bolivia privatize its water distribution systems in three large municipalities, including Cochabamba, its third largest municipality. It was believed that this would generate, or liberate, as the World Bank would prefer to describe it, $13 to $15 million of public funds. There's heavy subsidies going into water distribution. Aguas del Tunare won the concession contract in Cochabamba. Aguas del Tunare is the Bolivian incorporated firm that is largely controlled by a shareholder called International Water, which is essentially an empty shell corporation for Bechtel Corporation, San Francisco-based water multinational. So Bechtel calls all the shots, the principal shareholder in International Water and in Aguas del Tunare. One of the things that drove water prices up was this grand plan to divert water from the Chinarai Mountains to Cochabamba. It helped. It was something that local municipal politicians and state politicians wanted very much, and Bechtel did not want. And the World Bank, to its credit, actually advised against. Nevertheless, it was a very popular project, and it helped to drive some of the costs up. Sometimes water rates are sometimes doubled for local people in Cochabamba. On average, where the minimum wage is $100 per month, water bills rose about $20 per month. Traditional forms of water collection were outlawed. And all this was required, of course, because Aguas do Tunari and Bechtel were guaranteed an annual rate of return of 16% on their investment annually. High. And so water rates had to be increased in order to ensure that Bechtel got its return. Citizens of Cochabamba took to the streets in protest. The Coordinadora, led by Oscar Oliveira, who is a shoe factory worker and trade federation leader, became an international celebrity as a result. The Coordinadora, which was a civil society movement, remember that all the politicians were behind the privatization scheme until everybody took to the streets, essentially shut down the city numerous occasions. There were general strikes. Several months later, the Bolivian president called in the military. There was a state of emergency. 150 or so people are killed. Three people are injured, and three people are killed. Cochabamba is in a state of war, and Bolivia advises the Aguas del Tenari executives that their safety cannot be guaranteed. They flee the country, and Bolivia formally cancels the contract. And that's the story that's told by the anti-globalization movement. My friend Joel Backen ends the film, The Corporation, with this story. It's inspiring, right? But it's not the whole story. There's a whole other part of it, and it leaves out the corporate response, which was to sue. Under a Netherlands-Bolivia bilateral investment treaty, Aguas del Tenari was incorporated in the Cayman Islands at the time the concession contract was agreed to. It then shifted corporate headquarters and was reincorporated in the Netherlands, purportedly for tax reasons, but obviously also to take advantage of a Netherlands-Bolivia bilateral investment treaty. And that's indeed what the company did, was to sue under this Dutch bilateral investment treaty, a Dutch-Bolivian bilateral investment treaty, claiming anywhere from the range of $25 to $50 million U.S. Not precisely sure. As I said, the tribunal, after several years of delay, released its decision on jurisdiction and agreed that it would proceed to hear the substantive merits of the case. There are four principal lessons I identify, and I'll just, or three, and I'll just mention very briefly. First is that the local and transnational social movement actors have no place, as Stephen has described, in these proceedings. They were not entitled, Coordinadora nor allies in the North were not entitled to file amicus briefs in the case. These were strictly private proceedings, and only with the consent of the parties could some third party appear. And there have been recent modifications to ICSID rules that liberalize somewhat access for third parties, but it's still dependent on consent. Secondly, there's no avoiding the disciplines associated with investment rules. Bolivia had structured its agreement in a way that no company could take advantage of a bilateral investment treaty. Nevertheless, Aguas del Tenari and International Water, the principal shareholder in that company, could change corporate headquarters. Even though Bolivia never contemplated it was giving consent to a dispute that would arise between Aguas del Tenari and Bolivia, that consent is assumed and presumed when it signs a bilateral investment treaty. Thirdly, the nationality of the foreign investor is no longer of any consequence. You know, bilateral investment treaties are structured, of course, on nation-to-nation, state-to-state relations, and to protect, of course, the investor's home to each of those party states, it no longer makes a difference where they're from. International Water could move from the Cayman Islands to the Netherlands and a tribunal would not be interested too much. They're only interested in the formal legal capacity of the corporation, not in fact whether it was trying to, well, take advantage of a bilateral investment treaty. That's okay, much like a company would move corporate headquarters to take advantage of tax breaks. And so the tribunal described the bilateral investment treaty regime as a portal, an entryway. They're really portals for investment. As long as they're bringing investment in, it doesn't make a difference the nationality of that investor. So here it is. Here's the tribunal admitting that, you know, it's about a global web of agreements. It's intended to generate foreign investment. If foreign investment comes, it's succeeding on its own terms. So I maintain that this really is a worldwide web of investment disciplines. Despite the fact that Aguas Dulcinea won its claim on jurisdiction, I think it would have won the claim on the merits as well. I've written about this elsewhere, although precisely, well, we have a better view about what it was arguing, but there are many questions of fact and law that remain to be settled. But I would suggest to you that they had a very good chance of winning, yet withdrew. And why is that? And here I try and imagine whether there are, in fact, whether in fact there's room for counter-hegemonic practices or strategies. And this case provides, I think, an example of how those practices and strategies might be pursued. Not a lot of time to do that. But it begins with a San Francisco-based activist, Jim Schultz, who lives in Cochabamba and runs something called the Democracy Center, was reporting to at least the English-speaking world about events in Cochabamba, and mobilized his friends and connections in the San Francisco Bay Area to pressure Bechtel to essentially remove itself. This is in the first phase, remove itself from Cochabamba. And so activists in the Bay Area occupied the Bolivian embassy, remember who was the bad guy in the first phase, as well as the Bechtel headquarters. Schultz disseminated the email address of the president and CEO of Bechtel Corporation, Riley Bechtel. He was inundated with hundreds of thousands of email messages. In the second phase, Schultz also helped to precipitate the occupation of Bechtel offices and also conscripted the San Francisco Municipal Council. The Board of Supervisors approved a resolution calling on Bechtel to withdraw its claim against Bolivia in the second phase. This was important because the municipality was asking the company to withdraw the claim, suggesting that the municipality would not want to do business with that corporation otherwise. Civil society action ensued in Spain. There's a Spanish minority shareholder involved in international water. The King Juan Carlos and the Prime Minister of Spain called on the Spanish entity to help withdraw the legal claim. Oscar Oliveira became an international celebrity, lecturing around the world about events. And the cause got taken up by an organization based in Washington, D.C., the International Policy Institute. It's called International Policy Study Institute. Washington-based, as I said, and I've interviewed the director of political economy there who ran the campaign, parts of the campaign out of the Washington office. She organized protests outside the Virginia home of the lobbyist of Bechtel, and also organized a petition signed by 300 activists from five different continents, asking for ICSID to permit the intervention of the Coordinadora and other social movement actors into the proceedings. And I asked her about some of the reasons that Bechtel would have withdrawn from the case. What she described to me were mostly concerns on the part of Bechtel about bad publicity that would imperil future company profits. So I'm saying, of course, that's right, and that's all that it took. It was the company balance sheet. It was the sunk costs in Bolivia versus the potential future profits from Iraq. Bechtel is one of the biggest has been awarded some of the largest contracts in Iraq. New Orleans, after Hurricane Katrina, again, one of the largest contracts are awarded to Bechtel. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors rebuking Bechtel and telling them they should get out of the Bolivian the Bolivian suit. And lastly, the thousands and thousands of emails really irritated the president and CEO of Bechtel Corporation, and apparently this all of this got put under his skin, and so personally intervened in order to ensure that the case would be settled. So it seems that the transnational movement to put an end to the Aguas del Tenere claim on behalf of Bechtel was all about future lost profits, the threat of economic loss. And this, of course, is something that we know a lot about through much of the 20th century. The labor movement has used the threat of economic sanction. Ethical consumer activists, anti-sweatshop activists today try and use similar kinds of economic punishment to sway corporate production practices. And all of this suggests that despite the newness of this new constitutionalism, the tactics are actually to respond to it are actually going to be old, and the ones that we associate with modernity, and they include economic the threat of economic punishment through the power of consumerism or the power of shaming and blaming, but also I think through the old mechanism of the state, which will be really the most proper agent with which to unlock this investment rules regime. So thank you very much. Sorry I went over time.
Alors, je vais demander les questions de la salle. Jean-François?
Just one brief question. I'm to both of you, actually. I was wondering, obviously we've heard the positive narrative about Bechtel being forced to withdraw its suit, but to what extent have investors started using slaps like a strategic lawsuit against public participation, basically by saying to networks of citizens, you are harming our reputation, so right at the onset we're going to ask a court to shut you up, basically by getting an injunction not to engage in those tactics. Is it something that that has occurred lately, or is there any use of slaps against these types of counter-hegemonic actions?
No, not in this context, not that I'm aware of. There haven't been, I mean, there are an awful lot of claims. Mm-hmm. I think in the decade before, or the two decades before the year 2000, there might have been 45 foreign investor claims. I think there might be that many each year, or maybe more than that now. So the Bechtel fight back was important, but of course there are a lot of other complaints out there, and they haven't galvanized the community to respond in the same way that Bechtel. You know, when we win these battles, I was involved, and the Council of Canadians was very involved in the Bechtel fight back. And I was on Jim Schultz's email list. I mean, there was a happy coincidence of events, not the least of which was the fact that this corporation was based in San Francisco, which is a hotbed. But for the same reasons that Bechtel may have relinquished its claim, it would be disinclined to litigate against a particularly an influential and well-organized U.S.-based group that was taking it on. Okay. But maybe David may know of something.
In fact, it's not a common phenomenon. In fact, these kinds of this kind of public shaming is not common. You know, the whole regime was described as one constituted of secret tribunals by the New York Times only a few years ago. So this is a new phenomenon. So we might yet see slaps, but it took a great deal of effort, right, on behalf of social movement actors in numerous countries around the world to have this kind of effect, which, and so it's difficult to replicate. It's more likely to be successful against a large multinational company with something of a public face. Bechtel had one, I think, in San Francisco. But they also will have the deep pockets to reply with a slap suit. But it's all the other I think, potential claimants that are not large multinationals that, one, firstly, won't be able to shame very effectively, and secondly, even if you did, wouldn't convince the company to abandon its suit, because for these medium-sized enterprises, this is a big-ticket item, right? So you think about some of the claimants in NAFTA, the Feldmans or the Azinians or some of or Metalclad, and some of these medium-sized companies, they do the balance sheet calculation and they'll say, we're actually better off pursuing this and getting those profits than even yielding to this kind of public pressure if it ever were to arise.
Can I just add one comment? I think David's right, and it is interesting that grassroots mobilization can set back the agenda in a significant way, and not just in the case of Bechtel, but I mentioned briefly the multilateral agreement on investment. You know, that was a project of the OECD, and it failed because of the same type of grassroots resistance. And Canada played an important role in that, in the province of British Columbia as well, because it had public hearings into the MAI, and a lot of the critical analysis that came from Canada. Ultimately, it was the decision of the government of France to walk away from the negotiations that killed it, but that was built on a foundation of resistance that was quite international. So you do have civil society flexing its muscles in a way that brings surprising results. I mean, I think of myself as very much a part of that community, and I'm always surprised at how powerful the kind of the expression of democratic voice and resistance, even at, you know, at the community level. You wouldn't think that would impact the global initiative, but in the MAI case it did, and that's a far more, I think, substantial victory than even the Bechtel case.
I would dispute that interpretation of the MAI. I mean, what we've got is a worldwide, I've described this World Wide Web, we've got an MAI. The MAI victory was largely empiric, it was illusory in some ways. It mobilized people, it educated people, it's true. Citizens are more aware of these things than they were in the past, but the regime is in place and it's intended to last for a very long time, which another of its constitution-like features, it's intended to last generations. Getting out of it is exceedingly difficult, even if one has the will to do it. And so I think, I know I'm accused of being too pessimistic, which is why I took up, I wanted to investigate the Bechtel case. And it's discouraging, you know, while these stories are inspiring, overall one has reason to be discouraged.
Well, I agree that they came in through the side door with in the back door with the bits, and they have created by bits and pieces what they were trying to do as a formal multilateral.
That's sufficient. That's sufficient as long as companies can move around.
I'm not disputing that.
As Aguas del Tenari did. So you've got it.
Luc Tremblay, monsieur en arrière, Fabien, et puis Jean Leclerc.
Well, thank you for the presentation. I've learned a lot, and I have three general questions coming from the outside. The first question deals with... My first question would deal with what I call very interesting idea of critical globalization, or this kind of criticism coming from those who are... Our research is very interesting, but I'm wondering how it applies to the globalization in the field of human rights, because many comments or many criticism, like the erosion of sovereignty or democracy, applies there. So how would you react on this form or aspect of globalization? Would your criticism apply, or would you kind of distinction between the two areas? And the second question would deal with the idea of tribunal. I was very impressed by this idea. This is truly, you seem to borrow the model of private tribunal. So is there an alternative, or what kind of alternative would be applicable or acceptable, or should we get rid of the idea of tribunal for adjudicating this kind of challenge? And the third question is more conceptual. It seems to, I feel that I see a kind of confusion between the idea of constitutionalism as ideology and just constitutional limits. And I'm wondering if the concept of constitutionalism is applicable here. seems to me that the ideology is there to limit arbitrary action of the government in order to protect individuals. And to use this concept in this area seems to contain some perhaps confusion of concept. Maybe there's a debate in the
Start on human rights.
Yeah, sure. I'll just maybe take the first of those. In terms of human rights, well, first of all, it's important to recognize that we don't have anything in the sphere of international human rights law that is at all as significant or substantive or powerful as investor state suit litigation or even the dispute resolution regimes of the WTO. I think the most advanced model would be the one that exists under the Council of Europe's auspices. As in the multilateral context, it would be the optional protocol, I guess, to one of the covenants, to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The nature of the institution, some of the criticism applies. I mean, the nature of the institution is very different. The nature of the rights is very different. The nature of the beneficiaries of those rights is very different in that context. There's no, you know, there's no authority in the committee to actually issue awards that are binding. I mean, they may be binding in the abstract, but they're not materially binding on nation states that are out of compliance. So there's a dramatic difference. But could, and in fact, one of the things I find most irksome about the federal government's position is that whenever it comes to labor rights or environmental rights or human rights, it always invokes a concern about sovereignty to explain why it's unwilling to sign on. And in fact, it has done that around the whole notion of water as a fundamental human right, which some argue, and according to General Comment 15, is already engendered by the right to housing. And I always confuse the two covenants, but one of those two covenants. And Canada's kind of declined to accept that notion that the access to water is a fundamental human right. And why? Because it's worried about Canadian sovereignty and the potential for U.S. claimants against on Canadian water, which is absurd. And these are, of course, the same people that are willing to sell sovereignty down the river at the, you know, snap of a finger when it comes to international trade agreements. So you have this, but could there be at some point? And, you know, and I really think that there needs to be. I mean, what we've done is, you know, international human rights and international commercial rights might have existed under international law on kind of a reasonably level playing field in 1985, you know. And since then, what's happened is that the ascendancy of commercial rights has risen like a rocket ship, you know, and I think finds its culmination in industrial state litigation. Well, at the same time, human rights have kind of wandered in the wilderness, except that they've been diminished by this development. So I argue we almost have to, you know, accomplish a revolution where human rights are up here and corporate commercial rights are down there. After all, corporations, among other things, can't claim the same kind of entitlement as features of the human moral and ethical kind of condition, but also they're certainly better equipped to protect their interests than anybody else. But could there be? And this is an uninformed, my own personal view, and that is that you sacrifice sovereignty and the democratic process that goes with it in democratic states at your peril. And that intrusion in sovereignty that is represented by binding and enforceable international law may be warranted in certain cases, but you have to ask yourself, well, what's the rationale for the intrusion? And I think there are two. I think there are moral and ethical rationales, and I think you find those in crimes against humanity and, you know, the acts of genocide and the kind of jurisdiction that now the International Criminal Court has. And it's appropriate to intrude on sovereignty in order to protect those basic fundamental norms of the rights of human beings to be free from the most oppressive actions of the state. There's a moral and ethical justification. We can identify it. We can agree that the sovereign authority of nation states has to take a second seat to that. There's one other justification, I think, and that is practical. And I think those practical imperatives are found in the ecological problems we confront, in the, particularly those related to climate change and biodiversity loss, where we simply can't deal with the problems as disaggregated sovereign nations. There has to be a collective response because the nature of the problem is global and collective in its very character. You know, it's conceivable that some of the theorists would try to create that imperative or rationale in the context of trade agreements. I don't think you can, or if you could, it would be about reducing disparities, not accentuating them. And certainly the empirical evidence about globalization is that it tends to accentuate rather than reduce. But absent a moral or compelling practical imperative, we shouldn't intrude on sovereignty. So my answer for human rights is yes, it needs to develop. Yes, it could intrude on sovereignty. Would the same legal arguments we're making in this case apply at a practical and a formal level? I think not. But if they did, then we should amend the Constitution to allow them to develop, which in a way is the essential argument we make about Chapter 11. We say, look, the state can do this, but it has to amend the Constitution first.
And then there's the interesting phenomenon of investors and arbitrators and the treaties themselves blanketing themselves in the language of human rights. Right? So these treaties are replete with references to human rights, like non-discrimination. This shouldn't be a controversial idea. Right? The idea of a right to private property is a constitutional norm that has global scope. Shouldn't be controversial. And so this regime gains its legitimacy with reference to what Bakshi calls market-friendly human rights, to be distinguished from the human rights, the ones that we usually talk about when we use that phrase. About alternatives to tribunals, there are proposals kicking around. The International Institute for Sustainable Development out of Winnipeg is actually doing most of the work, I think, on alternative models. And so they're trying to re-envisage how the investment treaty regime might work and how the tribunal system might be reformed to make decision-making more representative, and so forth. So you should, you know, if you're interested, would look at that. I don't think that reform is going to solve the problem, in fact. So I'm with Stephen on this. It's a system that's not reformable. And the confusion of constitutionalism and ideology, the ideology of a constitution, is something that we would talk about, I think, for a while. I think that investment rules exhibit characteristics and features of national constitutional systems. They are not complete constitutional orders. However, you know, so they don't have there's a demos missing, right? Who are the people and constituting this regime? But there's an implied demos, actually. There's an implied citizen. There is an implicit constitutional order, but it's not a fully developed constitutional order, and the framers would deny that they're doing anything of the constitutional of the sort. And in which case, there's an interesting fight, I think, between those of us who say the regime has constitutional-like features and those who resist that, because then it becomes a fight over the politics of defining what is constitutional. And Gavin Anderson, in a recent book, has written about the politics of constitutional definition, and it's a fight, it's a political fight, in fact, over whether it's appropriate to call this constitutional or not. And I think that he's right. It ultimately is not about, it's not about law, but actually about politics.
Thank you.
I have a few questions as well. Just for other people to jump in, maybe I'll line them all one after the other. The first, my understanding was that your argument that the ultimate authority to settle investor state disputes that the ultimate authority to settle investor state disputes should rest with domestic courts. Yet, if you look at the Loewen decision, for instance, that took place in the United States, I'm curious to find out how you would sort of answer that question regarding would that investor have any right to question such a decision, which was done by domestic U.S. court. So that's the first question. Second question, if I understand your argument, and have you won in the Ontario court at the Supreme Court, at the Superior Court level, what kind of impact, or if you win at the appeals court level, what kind of impact do you think that will have for Canada's ability to engage or enter into, investment treaties, collateral investment treaties, et cetera, et cetera. Would that sort of diminish or undermine the country's capacity to have trade disputes that involve dispute settlement mechanisms that we have under NAFTA chapter 11? So would that sort of limit our capacity to have those? Or what kind of solution would we propose to Canada undertake if we want or if we are opposed to them to a sort? And thirdly,
excusez, mais il y a d'autres intervenants après, je vous demanderai d'arrêter là. Je m'excuse, je vais faire avant.
Do you want to hear other questions and then perhaps
answer them all?
Yeah, because we're getting short on time.
Yeah. Alors, Fabien?
Well, I also had a number of questions and I wanted to start with the most provocative. And the most provocative would be, how is the water supply at the moment, now that Bechtel has withdrawn? And my, essentially what I take from both of you is that sovereignty is best. And it seems to me, or the argument at least could be made, that sovereignty has been tried as a strategy for development, and it hasn't worked. So I'm putting my question in the simplest possible way.
Jean-Claire?
That's fine with me. I'm just trying to listen.
Okay.
Just one question. What do you believe might happen if globalization fails?
If what fails?
Globalization fails.
Globalization.
Why don't you start with low and low? Well, no, why don't you go ahead, Tom?
You want me to go ahead? Okay. Some very good provocative questions, so thank you. Thank you for those. About ultimate authority, domestic courts being the ultimate authority in regard to investor disputes, that could very well be the case. That might very well be the policy prescription that I would suggest, which doesn't mean that investors would be without any, ability to recoup losses. Private insurance is available. State-subsidized insurance is available. World Bank insurance is available, and that shifts the cost, obviously. Of losses by investors into developed and capital exporting states. So in fact there are mechanisms available that protect investors. It's not simply winner take all. It does mean that national judicial systems would be largely responsible for these things. And it means that investors and others should be concerned about judicial independence, right? Should be concerned about fair trial. Nobody's denying that those are not sort of fair considerations, and that we should be on the lookout for those things. So it's and it does mean ultimately that some investors will be at the whim of a perhaps corrupt court, in which case investors might be concerned about what the court system looks like. There's an interesting literature developing that suggests that rather than relying on an investment treaty framework, investors should be investing in a way in the development of judicial independence and a local court system that's fair and that operates well. And so, and which would give investors a stake in not just their sort of future profits, but a stake in development within the country itself in various ways. So it's not, it's that kind of stark option, it's either low end and you get that kind of unjust award against low end, or nothing, right, or this whole regime. And I'm suggesting to you there are various other things, alternative paths, right? This is my point. it limits our capacity to envisage alternative futures, alternative ways to deal with these problems, and means by which countries develop. And I'll just respond to Fabien's question about the water supply. It's not good, right? And there, because this Cochabamba case is such a well-publicized one, periodically there's a report in the New York Times or the Financial Times to make that very point, to say, aha, we told you so. This, you know, you needed this kind of investment because countries can't, a state like Bolivia doesn't have the money to develop its water system. That's precisely, of course, what gave rise to the privatization program, which is, again, which isn't to say that these countries don't need foreign investment, but that maybe foreign investment should enter on terms that are more fair and more subject to local control. The Coordinadora is now playing an important role in reforming the water supply. You'll read the stuff coming out of Bolivia, which will tell you that it's better and improving. It's still nowhere near as good as it would have been if the privatization experiment had succeeded. It's far from that. So access to water remains a real problem.
So, I agree with David that one of the points he made, I think, needs to be reinforced. I mean, two of the questions really speak to, well, don't the investment treaties serve a useful role in terms of facilitating foreign investment in developing countries where that investment might not otherwise occur? It's a different question than the privatization question, which is inherent in your question. But the foreign investment, so we deal with that in our material, and our factum's available online. You might want to look at it. There's simply not any evidence to substantiate the notion that you need an investment treaty in order to attract foreign investment. In fact, most investment seems to flow on along other lines for very different reasons. Canadian foreign investment is basically taking place in Europe, the United States, China, Cuba, a lot of places that it doesn't have investment treaties with. And UNCTAD has done a study, actually, of FDI and its relationship with foreign investment treaties and treaty law. And it simply isn't an effective and good way to attract foreign investment simply to negotiate 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 investment treaties with developed countries in order to attract. There's simply no empirical basis for drawing that relationship. And one of the point that David made that I think is important is that rather than disempower the institutions of the state, you want to build them up so that ultimately there's a predictability and a rule of law and the country is a good place to make an investment. And this arguably undercuts that capacity building project for developing countries. In terms of what the water's like, I work on water as a human right for the same for the Council of Canadians as a Blue Planet project, and we're trying to write new international law to strengthen the right that individuals have to water as a fundamental human right. And there are lots, there are 2 billion people in the world that don't have sanitation services. There are at least 1 billion that don't have access to potable water. It's been a long-standing problem. In a country as rich as Canada, we have huge needs for capital infusion in order to maintain, water and sewage infrastructure. It's a huge problem everywhere. For those who would say sovereignty hasn't worked, which is really, the question of public control and ownership and financing and management of water services, it's true, has it worked to meet the water needs of everybody in the world? But the privatization project is largely discredited as well, and we haven't been trying sovereignty in a very determined way because, money for infrastructure in developing countries is going to come through the multilateral development banks and the international financial institutions, and they have for years been conditioning their funding on various privatization schemes and neoliberal schemes related to expenditure reductions in the area of social services, and that clearly hasn't worked. And one of the things that I think is happening in consequence of those failed strategies of the international development banks, and probably because of the investor-state litigation as well, is there has been a withdrawal of foreign direct investment in developing countries, because the model simply doesn't work. And we would argue that the alternative, which has never really been tried in any determined way, is really the long, slow process of building the capacity of institutions in those poor countries, institutions of governance, institutions of dispute resolution, And that's the way we need to go. We've never really made a full commitment to that, and it's clear that the alternative models have failed. So the hard question is, what would happen if we win the case? I don't know. You know, I mean, it would obviously, hopefully, set in motion a chain of events that might lead to some meaningful reforms. It's difficult. At a certain level, it won't have any impact because Canada would still be bound. Well, I shouldn't say it won't have any impact. Canada would still be bound under international law to comply with the provisions of the agreement that it had signed. Arguably, you couldn't enforce the awards in Canada. So the domestic framework of implementation would be impugned. But you could still enforce against Canada in another jurisdiction. So hopefully, you know, it will create a bit of a constitutional flurry, if not a crisis, and it will begin to engage in the interest of a lot of people who aren't aware of this regime or at all attuned to its implications. How do you roll back to 2,500 investment? What was the last? Oh, the globalization project. What if it fails? It will fail. I mean, it is failing. I believe the rules of globalization, which are fundamentally rules of deregulation and privatization, disempowering the state, as you know, elevating the interests of corporate and private interests above collective interests and human rights interests, will fail. I mean, it will not be. It will exacerbate, and I believe it already is, the problems of climate change and biodiversity loss and the erosion of the capacity of governance and judicial institutions around the world to organize a response to those compelling challenges, including the challenges of human rights and the incredible disparity of opportunity and resources available to rich and poor. So it will fail. It is failing. The question is whether it will fail and be transformed into something that's sustainable in time, given the imperatives of, if not the human, at least the ecological problems that confront us. And I think that's the project. And at this point, the only people I could identify in the world that are engaged in it are the same people that fought back in Bolivia, and that's to re-empower the community, relocalize economies, and put the ecological security and basic human security at the top and everything else underneath. To the barricades.
Alors, je voudrais vous remercier beaucoup tous les deux pour nous avoir entraînés dans cette réflexion à la fois profonde et provocante et qui va, je l'espère, avoir des suites durable. Donc, je vous remercie en mon nom et à celui de tous nos participants, que je remercie à leur tour d'être venus ici aujourd'hui et que j'encourage à suivre dans l'avenir les autres réunions des matinées constitutionnelles.
Merci.